You ain't heard nothing yet.
Turn around, little
bitch. What
am I going to do?
Frankly, my dear,
I'm going to make him an offer.
You talking to me?
No! Are you not entertained?
I don't know who you are.
Why so serious?
When I'm good, I'm very good.
Simple.
But when I'm bad, I'm better.
He's a liar!
If they call me Mr.
Oh, boy's best friend is his mother.
You have no style.
You can bark all day, little dog.
No one!
Everyone!
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
Hello, and welcome back to the Tinsel Factory. My name is Caitlin, and I'm your host. Hope everybody had a great week. I had a slightly quieter one than last week, but it was still pretty busy. I think this is just me now. I'm just a busy little bee. Oh, God. I tried in vain to get Green Day tickets. They did a really small concert in, I think it was like downtown Glendale area, maybe like somewhere cuspy over there. I got into the queue at like number 4,000, and there was like 700 tickets for the whole event. So I was like, well, unless 3,000 people in front of me mess up, I'm not going to that. But, you know, that was disappointing. I went on a preview tour of the Universal Tram 60th anniversary that they're going to start doing, I think, this week. That was pretty awesome. You get off the tram. There's a bunch of photo ops. They gave it a very nice and very needed fresh coat of paint. It looks fantastic. If you hadn't gone in a while, the earthquake is back. It looked really, really good. But yeah, other than that, I played board games with friends. A week was had. For movie theater movie reviews, the only film I managed to see this week is Abigail, which is made by my day job. And you've been here before, you know the rules. I will say, though, just because I was kind of surprised as someone who, you know, is around the stuff, that despite what it looks like in the trailers for Abigail, it's the vampire ballerina movie, if you're unfamiliar. They don't give everything away in the trailers. It really, really looks like they do, but there's some nice twists and turns that they don't hint at all in the trailers. What you see in the trailer for the most part is maybe the first hour-ish of the movie. There's a couple other little things, but they're inconsequential. But as far as like what it gives away plot-wise, it's only the first half of the film. I was hoping that would be the case, and I was very glad that it was, because I really like these directors, and I hate it when trailers give everything away. But yeah, this one did not. It looked so much like it did. It did not. And then for Criterion stuff, not gonna lie, I was not in a huge movie mood this week, and I already had, I think it's all the shit I've been watching for this Alan Smithy stuff. So it happens every once in a while. I just can't bring myself to sit and watch a movie. I can watch 1,000 television shows and YouTube videos, but I can't sit through a movie, which is, you know, makes no sense, but that's just my brain now. I'm going to do a cop out and do a film that I did like that actually just got picked for the Criterion Collection, and that's going to be Spy Number 1226, which is Perfect Days. I reviewed it a couple of months ago. It was nominated for Best International Picture this past year at the Oscars. I saw it 2 months ago, and I can't stop thinking about it, so I'm just going to use my cop out. Really good movie. Highly recommend not sitting on that one. It is a very quiet film, so make sure you're in the mood for a movie, but yes, that is my decision for this week. And now let's get on to this week's topic. This week we're taking a look at a couple Alan Smithy films, as well as the process a director must go through to get his name removed from a film. With that, let's take our places. It's showtime.
It's been 30 years since they last attacked.
Here's your sister.
And now, the next chapter to Hitchcock's classic is about to unfold. The Birds 2, Land's End. Only on Showtime.
All right. I was totally correct in thinking last week when I was wrapping up the episode that I was going to need to do multiple films this week, because man, oh man, there is not a lot out there for these films. I had to actually order The Birds 2 on Blu-ray for the featurettes in order to do anything about The Birds 2 whatsoever. There is just nothing online about it or the making of it unless I just completely missed it, but it's like this movie exists and that's about it. There was like one article about Tippi Hedren and she wasn't really talking about the movie. It was a thing. Luckily, Vinegar Syndrome saved my ass. their release of The Birds 2 saved my ass, because they had a very nice featurette, which is what I used big time here today. But before we get into all that, let's take a look at how a director might decide to take on the Alan Smithy moniker for a film. It turns out that a director can't just have their movie be really, really bad and they just say, oh, I don't want, you can't just orphan your movie because it's bad. You have to, if you made it and you made that pile of garbage, you have to stand behind that pile of garbage. Sorry, you made an ass movie. Life will go on. To qualify for the Alan Smithy moniker, the director has to prove that their film was taken away from them and recut heavily against their wishes in ways that completely altered the film that the director was trying to make. Basically to the point where it can't be considered the director's work anymore. Yes, the shooting was obviously them, but the final assembly was not. And if the final assembly was not, then none of it reflects their true work, and therefore it's eligible for having their names removed. Directors are required to appeal to the DGA if this happens. They can't just do it on their own. Then it goes up to like a committee, and then the committee looks at the film and makes a final decision. If that appeal is successful, then the director's name is allowed to be replaced by Alan Smithy, and the director is instructed to never speak publicly about their participation in the film. Of course, people have spoken out about it because people, but more often than not, if you want your name taken off of it, you probably don't want to brag about it too much either. The Alan Smithy moniker can also be used on re-edits of films that air on TVs or air on TV or on airplanes, but we're going to get into that a little bit more next week. So now that we know how you can get Alan Smithied, let's look at some more of his work. So, if you remember from back in October of 2023, I did a bunch of episodes about Alfred Hitchcock, and during that time, we touched on the production and legacy of the 1963 film The Birds. It's one of Hitchcock's classics, you know, probably right behind Psycho and Vertigo when you're thinking of Hitchcock's movies. It's one of his big ones. Certainly, no one would want to try and top that. Well, in 1994, over 30 years later, somebody thought it would be a good idea to make a sequel to The Birds. It's called The Birds 2, Land's End. The plot is pretty basic compared to the film we're about to discuss a little bit later on. It's about the Hawken family who moves to a remote, tiny East Coast island with their two young daughters for the summer so the husband can work on his thesis. The family is also reeling from a death. The oldest son had died in a car accident about 5 years prior to the events of the film. So they're trying to get, you know, over that as well. So, you know, it's just a all-American family trying to spend a quiet summer in an East Coast island town situation. That is not to be, because an angry flock of birds begin causing chaos around the small town, and an old-timer recalls a similar terrifying situation 3 decades prior in a sleepy coastal town in Northern California. Are the two connected? What happens next? I won't tell. Shooting for The Birds 2 took place in the Wilmington, North Carolina area. Ironically enough, they were shooting on sound stages at the same lot as The Crow, which was the film that Brandon Lee was shot and killed on. And, you know, Crow, The Birds. Based on that, because they don't really specify, but just I know when The Crow got shot, The Birds 2 would have been shot around the summer of 1993. The actual director was Rick Rosenthal, who had made a name for himself after directing Halloween 2 in 1981. Other than that, not a lot available about this dude online. As far as his abilities on the set of this film, though, opinions kind of differ. One guy definitely didn't like him, so there was definitely a bias there, and I tried to factor that in, but everyone else was being, like, suspiciously nice, so it was confusing. I'm sure he sounds like he's a lovely dude. I don't know if he was super adept at directing, but, you know, who am I to judge? One member of the props team, the one who doesn't like him, recalls a simple scene taking far too long to shoot, in his opinion. It was basically the lead actor and another character on a porch, so nothing terribly technical. He said there was way too many shots being taken. He's like, maybe it was first day nerves, but he was, you know, he's an old set guy, been doing it forever. But he just kind of took that as an omen of things to come. A PA from the film that was interviewed recalled the shoot not being too crazy, all things considered. They were working like 14 to 16 hour days, which, given the amount of special effects, kids, and animals involved, not exactly surprising. About 3 years, 4 years, within 5, let's just say within 5 years of this shoot, hours on set got heavily reduced and policed. They still go over all the time. I've gotten triple overtime before, but they got restricted more and more rules were put on things after an event we'll eventually cover in a future episode, I'm sure. But it involved a member of a film crew falling asleep at the wheel and dying because he'd worked like a 20-hour day, something insane. But yeah, that was in the early 90s, a 14 to 16-hour day on a film set was not unheard of, especially on something like this. The script for The Birds was written by Ken and Jim Wheat, and according to the cast and crew, was quote-unquote ever-changing. This included having to remove popular songs that the children were supposed to sing in a car scene towards the beginning of the movie. The actress who played the youngest daughter, Stephanie Milford, ended up having to make up a song on the day of shooting because the filmmakers had only just realized that there wasn't going to be a chance in hell they were going to be able to afford the rights to the song that was written into the script. Apparently, it was a theme song of a popular children's show at the time, so it was probably like a Disney show or a Nickelodeon show. There's absolutely no way they were going to get that cleared, because this was Universal, so they didn't really have anything much in the way of kids' television back then. Milford, who was all of 9 at the time, made up a song for her and her on-screen sister to sing on the spot. She took like the B-I-N-G-O bingo song and changed it to the name of the dog that they have in the movie. Like a very simple, very effective solution. But it just kind of goes to show that when the 9-year-old is running creative laps around a seasoned group of film professionals, there's a pretty good sign that there's other issues afoot as well. Tippi Hedren, the star of the original Birds, has a small part in this film and was apparently paid vukus of money to do so, but she would later describe the whole thing as a horrible experience. Her character in this film, by the way, was not the one she played in the first film. Totally unrelated. As far as production that people were, I guess, willing to say on camera, Rosenthal did allegedly have issues with the producers, though no specifics were ever cited publicly. And the prop master, per the same PA that I mentioned earlier, and I'm pretty sure it's the one that gets interviewed in the thing, they don't explicitly say it, but you can kind of tell by the energy that he puts off, because there'll be 5 people going, oh, Rosenthal was really great. And then he'll come up and be like, yeah, no, not really. One thing I found absolutely hilarious from the documentary was how passive aggressive people started getting by specially made t-shirts. Like, it's such a weird thing to be like, to be snarky through. So basically what happened, the crew were given shirts that said like The Birds 2 on them. It's a very common cast crew gift, just a t-shirt with a logo of the film on it. The assistant to the prop guy apparently wrote fuck you underneath the Birds 2 logo, like in the same font and everything in a Sharpie, and I guess wore it to set, which pissed off the producers like big time. In response to that, Rosenthal had shirts printed that said, quote, 4 dead birds, which was a reference to the 4 dead fake birds props had provided for a scene that was supposed to feature dozens, if not more, dead birds, which had infuriated Rosenthal. Those shirts were given to everyone on set except props and the producers, and people would actually wear them on set. So no Fs were given. But yeah, like I said, overall people had widely positive things to say about Rosenthal. Rosenthal's ultimate removal from the film kind of started during reshoots, which were done to make the film gorier. Literally the first scene of the movie, if you seek this out and watch this, it's a reshoot. That is not how the movie was even supposed to open. These scenes were just not a part of his vision. Rosenthal had wanted the film to be more suspenseful, a la Hitchcock, but the studio wanted an out-and-out horror film and to capitalize on the bird's name. Eventually, the film was re-edited with the new material against Rosenthal's wishes, and that's ultimately why he took his name off of it. When the film was released on Showtime, who bought the film after it was deemed not good enough for a theatrical release, the crew expressed dissatisfaction with the final product, as it was not the project they set out to make, and critics agreed with that assessment. It was not good. If you're a Schitt's Creek fan, by the way, The Birds 2 was the inspiration for The Crows, the film that Moira's a star of. It's based on The Birds 2. Today, The Birds 2 is a bit of a cult fan favorite, but like Death of a Gunfighter, not easily available online, but you can get a DVD Blu-ray copy pretty easily, which is what I had to do. No regrets. Overall, I didn't think it was that bad. It's cheesy. It's very of its time. It's very early 90s, but I don't regret watching it at all. It was a smidge boring, and the gore did absolutely nothing as far as making it better. It rarely does, let's be honest, but it was fine. I keep expecting to see these, like, and I have seen some trash. I've seen clips of some trash. But overall, it's just, I've been told my whole life that these movies are terrible. These movies are terrible. And I've yet to see anything terribly egregious, to be honest. Like, they're not great movies, but they're not bad, bad. Like, it's been an eye opener. I've learned much this month. I think that's why I've not been watching a lot of other movies, just because I'm taking everything in. At the end of this and learning about The Birds 2, I think this film and all the other sequels and remakes of Alfred Hitchcock's films that have been released, there's a lesson there, and I feel like it's pretty obvious. You can't and frankly shouldn't remake or sequel or try to outdo a Hitchcock film. It's not going to work out for you. And it's never a director, like it's never like a Spielberg or a Nolan or anybody like of caliber. It's just like some mid director being like, no, I could do better. You can't. Leave the Hitchcock movies alone. Come up with your own ideas. Now, let's look at one of Smithy's other masterpieces, which is the 1996 horror movie Hellraiser Bloodline. First off, a synopsis of what happens in this movie, because this one's a little crazy, and you kind of need to know it for me to explain it. It's just buckle up. In the year 2127, an engineer named Dr. Paul Merchant locks himself in his cabin aboard a space station that he designed. Security tries to break in because Merchant's doing some crazy stuff with a robot to solve the Lament configuration, which is a mysterious box that summons demons from hell. The guards break through the door, apprehend Merchant, who is brought to Rimmer, their leader, to explain why he's so freaking crazy. So he tells her. His story goes back to Paris in 1796. His ancestor, Philippe Le Marchand, is a French toy maker who is making the Lament configuration on commission. He does not know what it is for. Upon delivering the box, he peeks in through the windows like a sneaky little bad boy and sees his client sacrificing a peasant girl to summon a demon into her body named Angelique, and the box is like a conduit for it. Horrified by all of this, obviously, Le Marchand runs home, where he begins working on blueprints for a second box, which will contradict the actions of the first. Le Marchand eventually attempts to steal the original box, but discovers that his client's assistant has killed him and has pledged himself to Angelique. He's now, like, in charge of her. That part didn't quite make sense because she's a demon and he's in charge. It didn't make sense. Anyway, the pair end up killing Le Marchand, but before they do so, tell him that his bloodline is now cursed because of his involvement in making the box. Then we fast forward to 1996, where Le Marchand's descendant, John Merchant, has built a skyscraper in Manhattan that resembles the Lament configuration. Seeing an article on that building in a magazine, Angelique, who's still in Paris, demands her assistant to take her to it so she can confront him. Assistant says no, so she kills him and travels to Manhattan, but she fails to get what she wants. Eventually, she discovers the Lament configuration in the building's foundation, tricks the security guard into solving it, and then our big bad for the previous three films, Pinhead, finally shows up. They have a little fight, as Pinhead represents kind of a shift in the practices of hell that have occurred in the intervening 200 years, basically since Angelique has been gone, and she's like a princess. I think if I remember correctly, she's like the daughter of Leviathan, if you know your hell story stuff. Believe she's the daughter of Leviathan, so she's like a princess of hell, and she's informed that, you know, things have gotten a little bit creepier since she's been gone, and despite that, they ultimately forge an alliance because they need to kill Merchant, because Merchant could potentially, like, mess up all their, you know, their plans and messing with people and, you know, doing all this stuff via a contraption called the Elysium configuration, which is the thing that Le Marchand tried to make back 200 years prior. If the box works, it would create a perpetual light that would permanently close all the gateways to hell. Merchant's prototype ultimately fails, he gets killed, but his wife manages to open Angelique's Lament configuration and sends Pinhead and Angelique back to hell. So now we go back to 2127, where Rimmer thinks Dr. Merchant's story is absolutely just bananas and has him locked up. But as we saw in the opening scene, Dr. Merchant has successfully gotten the demons out of the box and Pinhead and his followers, which now include a cenobited up Angelique. She looked like just a person for like the first hour of this movie. And then she really does not look like a person after that. They've been let out on the spaceship. They kill everybody on the spaceship except for Rimmer and Dr. Merchant to escape. The two then have to figure out how to defeat Pinhead and the Cenobites once and for all, lest their hellish ways seep into the real world. I think part of it was involving the fact they're on a spaceship, so it'd be a little bit harder for them to get out, but, you know, I don't think that much thought was put into this. So I'm not going to go too much into the Hellraiser franchise's background for reasons that will make sense in October. Spoiler alerts, but all you really need to know right now is that Hellraiser was created by horror novelist Clive Barker. He adapted his book, The Hellbound Heart, into the 1987 film Hellraiser, which I did not know was a book until this week. 14-year-old edgy emo that I was would have absolutely loved to read that freaking book. I probably will still eventually, but my to-be-read pile is insane right now. The Hellraiser franchise features one constant between each films, and that's the group called the Cenobites that go after anyone who summons them. They are from a religious sect in hell known as the Order of the Gash, who describe themselves as, quote, explorers in the further regions of experience, and they like to grant sadomasochistic pleasures to those who summon them. Leading the group is Pinhead, a terrifying dude with a white face and nails in his head. In case you were wondering where that name came from, it's that. After the 1987 film, a sequel followed a year later that was pretty well received, about equally with the first one. And a third one followed in 92, and it was seen not as good as the first two, but still pretty good for a third entry in a film franchise, especially a horror franchise. But it's the fourth one that would be the Alan Smithy production. Clive Barker, now acting as an executive producer and not as a director or writer of these films, wanted a revamp of sorts for the series after three Hellraiser films that were all pretty similar to each other. They're different enough, but there's a lot of overlap. An initial premise was set for the film, which involved a shape-changing something or other that would be used to trap Pinhead. This was inspired by the ending of Hellraiser 3, which featured a building whose architecture resembled the Lament configuration. Barker suggested the three-part film format set in different eras, which of course ended up being in the final product, and Peter Atkins, the screenwriter for Hellraiser Bloodline, added the Les Marchands storyline. Atkins had previously written Hellraiser 2, and he'd co-written Hellraiser 3, so he was very familiar with the world that he was being thrown into. Atkins and Barker ultimately pitched the idea to Miramax, the studio, who greenlit it without even requiring a full outline of what they wanted to do. That would end up being a mistake. On whose part? Hard to say. Atkins' screenplay was linear initially and had more special effects than previous iterations of the Hellraiser films, including the fight scenes between Pinhead and Angelique. But Miramax wasn't willing to shell out the cash for these things to be realized, so the film had to be scaled back. When it came to the helming of the project, a couple of directors cycled through, but eventually special effects technician Kevin Yeager was hired. As a special effects technician, Yeager had created the iconic look for Freddy Krueger for 1984's A Nightmare on Elm Street, as well as the Crypt Keeper for the HBO horror anthology show, and freaking Chucky. Like, he was involved in all the designs of all those very iconic horror looks. So this dude knew what scary was. He made some of the most iconic horror images of the 80s and 90s, for goodness sake. This was not Yeager's first directing gig either. He was first brought on as a cost-saving director for a couple episodes of Tales from the Crypt. So he had at least proved that he kind of knew what to do. Yeager was initially hesitant about taking the Hellraiser job, as he did not want to do a revisit of the previous installments of the series. But after talking with Atkins and Barker, he changed his mind. But the script was still being scaled back, so by the time they were shooting, it was a different script. The second round of scaling back in the name of cost cutting led to a number of characters being reduced or merged together, and several were rewritten to have just simpler backgrounds and affectations. Filming for Hellraiser Bloodline began in Los Angeles in August of 1994. Locations included the I Magnin building and an abandoned factory, which was what they made the spaceship out of. Problems with production began early and continued throughout. Doug Bradley, who played Pinhead, called it, quote, the shoot from hell. Why? Well, amongst other things, the cinematographer was replaced, the assistant director had to leave due to a personal emergency, several people got hella sick, and Bradley said that in addition to the DP, that the art department and the rest of the camera crew were all fired during the first week. Despite these issues, Hellraiser 4 was completed on time and within its budget. But the issues weren't over. The initial cut of the film, shown to studio executives in early 1995, was 110 minutes, so almost 2 hours, which is a long time for this kind of a horror movie. These tend to thrive around 90 minutes, hour 40. The executives at Miramax absolutely hated it. They wanted Pinhead in the film more, and they wanted him in the film sooner. Atkins would say later that they knew the script, so they knew when he entered the film, but believe they possibly panicked when it was actually pieced together, and they saw how long it took for Pinhead to actually show up. Miramax's demands meant extensive rewrites, and Pinhead was inserted into the opening of the film, which was changed so that the 22nd century Paul Merchant narrates his ancestor's story, and a happy ending was added. Spoiler alert. Yeager was burnt out after the initial shoot and declined to be involved, so he left the production, citing a lack of time and energy. Though he was not necessarily opposed to Miramax's suggested changes, Yeager said he also did not want to see the film slowly morph into a different product after all of the hard work and time he had put in. Director Joe Chappelle was brought in to direct the reshoots. Atkins wrote 3 new scenes for it, and when he became unavailable, Barker recommended Rand Reich, who had previously worked on Candyman, Farewell to the Flesh, to step in. New footage was shot in April and May of 1995. Bradley said they consisted of entirely new material and were not truly reshoots. Reshoots are like something was wrong and he had to kind of go back and fix it. This is just additional shooting. Angelique's origin and relationships with Pinhead and the Les Marchands line were changed from the original script to what I just described. I couldn't find the original script to see what that was. But I did read it in 2 different places that happened. The Les Marchands storyline was apparently way longer and was heavily reduced. Angelique and Pinhead originally had a more violent relationship. They represented the old guard and the new one and the changing ideas of one generation to another. That was heavily reduced. And the theatrical cut of this film makes this relationship very ambiguous and replaces some of their hostility with sexual tension because, of course. After all of this was done, the film was cut down to a very lean 85 minutes. When Yeager saw this new version of Hellraiser, he felt it was too different from his original vision, so he had his name removed from the credits, and Alan Smithy took his place, as Chappelle hadn't filmed enough of the new material to warrant a credit of his own. Apparently, and I only found about it today, so like Saturday, this is like Saturday at 3 p.m. as I'm recording this. I learned today that there is apparently a leaked early work print of Bloodline that's just floating around. I did a little bit of Googling, but I couldn't find it. Maybe I'll do a little bit after I finish this if I'm not too tired. But apparently it does exist and it was floating around and it does apparently restore some of the lost footage, but it's still missing quite a bit from the original cut. Unsurprisingly, Bloodline was not screened for critics, which is a fun little hot tip for y'all. If you go on Rotten Tomatoes and it's like Thursday afternoon and a movie has no tomato score, that means they didn't screen it for critics, and that means it's probably just absolutely trash-tastic. More often than not, that's the case. The film was released on March 8th, 1996 in the US and Canada, where it grossed $4.5 million in its opening weekend, which left it in 5th place. Bloodline has the distinction of being the final Hellraiser film to receive a theatrical release. Today, there are 11 Hellraiser films in all, and the intervening 7 have all been direct-to-video or streaming. Atkins believes this was due to the mishandling of Bloodline's post-production. Once critics got their eyes on it, they went off. One critic called it a, quote, pointless mess, and another one said it was the most ambitious of the Hellraiser films, but definitely the worst one. Atkins said he was uninterested in exploring more Hellraiser stories, as he could not see anywhere for the series to go creatively, but he recognized Miramax had a financial interest in keeping the series alive. Atkins was later quoted saying about the whole experience, quote, if Miramax hadn't effed Kevin Yeager over so badly, ripped his budget in half, taken it away from him, driven him to the Alan Smithy credit. If they'd allowed him to direct the movie we all thought we were going to make, and these are all ifs, and if that movie had been a bigger hit, there might well have been a theatrical Hellraiser 5 that might still have involved me and or Clive. Both of them stepped away after this. And I mean, the CGI is very cheap looking. I doubt there was much money thrown in it. And it was, you know, the mid 90s. It does not look great 30 years on. But overall, I watched it this morning. I've seen worse films. It is a shame to watch because it is very ambitious. It's a very interesting take on a horror film just to kind of discover like how this generational trauma line through. There's pieces there that could have made this thing so flippin' cool. And it almost makes it worse because you just see all this potential of what this film could have been and it just all falls apart and it all breaks apart and it's just not quite there, but it's so close. Having looked at both of these films this week, I would say that the overreaching message to take away from today is to never let executives have a ruling hand in the final product of a film. Yes, they can have opinions. They paid for it, of course. But I cannot think of a situation where that has gone well, like any situation where extensive rewrites, extensive reshoots were demanded. I cannot think of the top of my head where someone went, you know what? The executives are right. It's so much better now. I'm sure there has to be like at least one, right? But I don't know any of them. And these two were prime examples today. They were both decent films. Like, they weren't inherently bad. They weren't inherently good, but the directors never had a chance to fully realize what they wanted to do. You've got to trust your talent. Otherwise, what are we doing here? Like, executives, you pay them the money. No executives are listening to this. You got to pay money to the people that you trust to be able to put together a thing and just trust that they know what they're doing. Just because you're an executive does not mean you know everything. Mr. David Zaslav is very much proof of that. So yes, these are two movies that I would recommend giving a watch. I didn't regret it. These two films are excellent example of what happens when executives think they know better than the artists they hire to make art. That's all I got. I can't even think of a smart, like, quippy end. I'm just, like, so disheartened. I shouldn't have watched them back to back. Anyway, here, listen to some things from Hellraiser.
Just back it up against the wall. You heard him. Back it up. Don't make us put some pain on you.
Pain? How dare you use that word?
He's got pins in his head.
What you think of as pain is only a shadow. Pain has a face. Allow me to show it to you. Gentlemen, I am pain.
And that's going to do it for this week. If there's anything you'd like me to cover in the future, please reach out on social media where I also post photos for each episode at Tinsel Factory Pod on Instagram, on Facebook at The Tinsel Factory, or you can always email me at tinselfactorypod@gmail.com. I've got a Letterboxd account which features my watch lists, film diary, and recommended viewing for this episode. You can check it out at the link in the show notes. I'm relying on word of mouth to get this podcast out there, so if you could please rate, review, and subscribe so that other people can find this podcast, that would be a huge help. In order to keep making the podcast, I've also set up a support page, the link of which you can find in the show notes. If you'd like to help out in any way, I'd very much appreciate it. I forgot to look at my emails, so the person who sent me a coffee, I will thank you next week, but thank you. I have not had coffee today, and I am feeling it, but the anxiety of getting this done was enough to drive me through the day caffeineless, so go me. Also, shame on me. I've also got merch. Check it out, the link in the show notes. Next week, we take a look at Alan Smithy's work on a television edit and the film that finally took the Alan Smithy name out of rotation. We'll also go a little bit into, because Alan Smithy is not the name used anymore, but what name is used now? How do we know what name it is? All will be revealed next week. Thanks again for listening. And until next time, that's a wrap.